Good morning. We have a... a complicated schedule this morning of oral arguments. I won't go through them one by one because that would take half your time. I'll just ask Bonnie to announce the case, and we'll go ahead and get started if you'd like. Ready, counsel?
Yes,
Your Honor. Proceed.
May it please the court. Russell Barton on behalf of Jerry Durant, the Durant entities, and Doyle Maynard. There are a number of issues in this appeal. The briefs detail numerous errors as to liability and damages. In my time today, I would like to focus on the damages issues, beginning with the fraud damages. In question number one, the jury refused to find that a contract existed, but the trial court awarded benefit of the bargain damages for fraud. In the recent Zerilla case, as well as Synixon and Glasner, the Supreme Court has made it clear that absent an enforceable contract, a fraud claimant cannot recover benefit of the bargain damages. And I want to briefly address Anderson's Sir reply regarding the Zerilla case. Anderson basically argues that the fraud question here submitted both a fraud question and an entirely different contract question than what had been submitted in question number one. But in Zerilla, there was a separate jury finding of the existence of a contract. The jury separately found breach of contract and fraudulent inducement, awarded the exact same damages for both theories, and the plaintiff elected to recover under the fraud theory. That's not what happened here. And there is no evidence to support the argument in the Sir reply that the jury in the fraud question found a contract or a promise to convey a 10% interest in both dealerships without the real estate. Anderson expressly pleaded that damages for fraud were exactly the same as the contract damages, and that included, says Anderson, the real estate. Anderson only testified that the offer or the promise was for both dealerships and the real estate. On the other hand, Jerry and others testified that the offer was only for one dealership, subject to net profit thresholds and the like. But there simply is no evidence to support the phantom contract or promise that Anderson asserts in the Sir reply. Defamation damages. There is no evidence of causation. Jerry talked to four people. Jerry and Mr. Cote had a private closed-door meeting with Mr. Anderson. Anderson does not claim that that caused him any harm. Jerry also talked about his suspicion with Don Allen, Cote, and Doyle, all Durant management personnel. There is no evidence that Don, Cote, or Doyle repeated Jerry's statements of suspicion to anyone. Regarding Doyle Maynard, he had a private discussion with Jerry, and he had one with a co-manager named Eddie Bermia. There's no evidence that Doyle's statements were repeated. No evidence connects Jerry or Doyle's statements of suspicion to anyone outside Durant management. So, On page 49 of his brief, Anderson argues that Jerry is liable just because he relayed his suspicion to management. In other words, Jerry could investigate, but he just couldn't say anything. That's not the law under the Randall Food Markets case. And moreover, as to all of the appellants, not one witness testified that he or she believed any of the statements or rumors. And not one witness testified that any rumor affected his or her opinion about Anderson. The Hancock and Burbage cases reiterate that reputational harm is concerned with the recipient believing the statement. And there's no evidence of that.
Wasn't there one dealer that he applied for a job with who said, I couldn't take the risk, basically? Understanding, if I'm recalling it correctly, that he'd already given the job to somebody else, but didn't he say that he couldn't take the risk?
That's right, Your Honor. In the context of a hypothetical future job, he testified that he thought Anderson had a really good reputation. The fact that he testified if a job in the future became available, he would consider Anderson pending the outcome of the trial is no evidence that Anderson was refused employment because of a damaged reputation. What the cases make clear is that in excess of presumed harm for nominal damages, the Burbage case, the waste management case, even in a defamation per se case, that there has to be evidence of actual harm. And the lack of causation here just carries right over into the lack of evidence to support the general damages, such as the reputation damages. There is no evidence that Anderson suffered an actual loss of reputation. There's no evidence that any of the five or six people that Anderson talked to about a job refused to hire him because of his reputation. As I just discussed, Mr. Hiley testified he thought Anderson had a really good reputation. Ultimately, Anderson was hired by Frank Kent in a management position, later promoted to an even higher management position. And the owner of Frank Kent, Will Churchill, testified that Anderson came highly recommended and that when Anderson was promoted, he was handpicked to be a part of that new management team. There simply is no evidence that Anderson sustained an actual loss of reputation either in the past or in the future, and there's no evidence to support the identical amounts of damage that the jury awarded for past and future lost reputation. There's also no evidence of severe mental pain or distress. Our brief details a list of the conclusory sound bites that Anderson testified to, things such as having trouble eating and sleeping, trouble focusing, anxious, anxiety, a two-word sentence, financial worries. All of those conclusory sound bites are no evidence of severe mental pain or distress. Statements that this destroyed him or that he was devastated, that's no evidence of severe mental pain or distress. That's the Guerra case out of the Supreme Court. There's no evidence that Anderson was diagnosed with depression. His doctor didn't testify. Anderson's wife and family did not testify. There's no evidence of when any of these symptoms began, how often he experienced them. There's no evidence of when he was prescribed medication, how often he had to take it. And his testimony about being worried about the future and worried about his finances, is no evidence of severe mental distress or pain. That's the Sayens case out of the Supreme Court. There's no evidence of a substantial disruption in daily routine. Anderson testified that calls were coming in immediately. Mr. Hiley was one of those calls. He was doing what people do when they're out looking for a job. Ultimately, he was hired by Frank Kent in a managerial position, and there's no evidence that any alleged mental anguish affected his job performance, much less that it was a substantial disruption in his job performance. Regarding future mental anguish, Anderson made no mention of that at all. And again, his doctor didn't testify. There simply is no evidence to support either that Anderson actually suffered mental anguish or to support the identical amounts awarded by the jury. And, you know, the jury awarded the exact same amount of money for four different elements of damage: past reputation, future reputation, past mental anguish, future mental anguish. That in and of itself shows that the jury was just picking a number out of the air. Those amounts just represent disapproval of the defendants. They're not based on evidence, and they have to be reversed. With respect to lost income, there's no evidence that defamation actually caused Anderson to suffer lost income. This is not a case where a person makes a defamatory statement to an employer who then turns around and fires the defamed employee. Anderson's employment was terminated at the January the 4th meeting, not because of any defamatory statement. There simply is no evidence that any statement by any appellant actually caused a loss of income, especially since there's no evidence that anybody believed any of the rumors. So for these reasons and for the reasons set forth in our brief, we would ask that the court reverse and render, or alternatively reverse and remand.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Head.
May it please the court, Alban Head for the defendants, Robert Cote, Elliot Mickelson, Gary Deere, and Jerry Rash. Insofar as the background of these individual defendants, Mr. Cote was a former United States Air Force Special Investigator, decorated as such, and then after retirement from the Air Force went to work for the Arabian American Oil Company, Aramco, in Saudi Arabia. In the same internal control and investigation position. After retiring there and moving here, he went to work for the Durant Organization as a internal control person. Mr. Cote was sued for defamation in this case, principally for statements made by him to Mr. Anderson in the December 28th meeting with Mr. Durant present. These statements were made in the federally mandated polygraph consent form, which is Exhibit 24. Mr. Mickelson worked for Manheim Auto Auctions nearly all his career. He was sued simply because he answered a phone call that was placed to him by Mr. Jake DeCoker, the person alleged to have been making under the table or kickback or Duke payments to the plaintiff Anderson. Mr. Deere is a retired independent wholesaler, not connected with Durant, and he was sued simply because he came in on an ongoing conversation between Chuck Terrell and Robert Shapiro at Mr. Shapiro's dealership, and for making the statement that he had seen Andrew Anderson and Mr. DeCoker sitting in a car on several occasions together. Mr. Rash is a buyer, wholesaler, independent, working for RLB Investments, and he was sued because he told Gerald Bolton, an auto dealer in Waco and a longtime friend of Mr. Durant, that Mr. Durant's inventory was out of whack or out of balance. As you know from our briefing, we have incorporated all of the arguments regarding defamation made by the Durant defendants, and we incorporate and agree with Mr. Barton's statements here today. I'm not going to reiterate any of those points, but do want to emphasize that there is no evidence as to any causation with regard to any statements made by our defendants, and there is no evidence of any harm that those statements are alleged to have caused. The testimony revealed that no one believed any of the alleged statements. Additionally, there are a couple of factual issues I'd like to point out briefly in my small time here. As to Mr. Cote, Mr. Anderson testified that the reason he sued Mr. Cote was because Mr. Cote read the polygraph consent form to Anderson in front of Mr. Durant. Obviously, statements made to Anderson are not defamatory publications. And moreover, the language in the consent form, again, Plaintiff's Exhibit 24, is couched in terms of, quote, it has been alleged, quote, you are suspected of receiving wrongful compensation. The form doesn't say anything about kickbacks, and it advises him that he doesn't have to take the test if he doesn't want to, which he signed. Anderson further testified that Mr. Durant had reason to be suspicious of his activities. Mr. Mickelson answered a phone call from Mr. DeCoker, who said that he had already been told that he had been accused of taking money from me, from DeCoker, on those cars. And that's in the record at page 25, volume 20, page 22, 25, and 42, where it says DeCoker testified, so I knew it wasn't true. What we have here is a scatter shot at multiple defendants, some of whom settled. Gerald Bolton received a summary judgment. We have what happened here was gossip within the industry, much of which was fostered by the plaintiff, Mr. Anderson, himself. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Okay, next.
Please the court. Mr. Head just said that Mr. Cote got sued for telling one person. The evidence in the record was Mr. Cote told a gentleman by the name of Mark Clark, who had no affiliation with the dealership, had been fired by the dealership, told Mark Clark that Mr. Anderson was nothing but a crook, a thief, and took kickbacks. Mr. Cote also told another gentleman, Mr. Durant's son, who wasn't involved in the organization, wasn't working for the organization, that he was investigating kickbacks. And he told another gentleman, Mr. Opitz, who wasn't involved in the investigation at all. The final judgment is proper in all respects and should be affirmed. For 2 months, a jury heard the evidence and came to a just conclusion based upon the evidence presented at trial. The problem with most of Durant's arguments is that they were flatly rejected by the jury, and they want this court to likewise ignore compelling evidence to the contrary. For example, they want this court to ignore that Mr. Durant unequivocally testified he had no evidence to support this vicious and career-ending allegation that Mr. Anderson took kickbacks. And worse, he told the jury that he believed Mr. Anderson was going to pass the very lie detector test that was set up that Durant made him take in connection with the accusation that Mr. Durant had made.
Durant made him take the polygraph? That's not the way I read it in that testimony.
Well, he consented to the polygraph, absolutely. But Mr. Durant testified that he believed that Mr. Anderson was going to pass the test, which goes right to the heart of all their arguments with respect to the investigation privilege. We all know that the investigation privilege is a qualified privilege. It can be defeated with a showing of actual malice, with a jury finding of actual malice, and it is defeated by the jury's finding of actual malice here. Now, with respect to the fraud case, the Zerilla case, they make two very superficial arguments. They say the jury didn't find a contract in question one, therefore we lose. And they also say, in any event, the statute of frauds bars any recovery. We know the statute of frauds doesn't apply by the way they answered the fraud question. They awarded no damages for the real property. The statute of frauds is no way implicated by the false promise that they found. What the Zerilla case says, and I'm quoting, quote, accordingly, if the promise underlying the jury's fraud finding is unenforceable, no sustainable measure of fraud damages was submitted to the jury. And the Zerilla court goes on to state the contract question is subsumed within the fraud question. They say you have a promise, reliance, and an agreement. They say you look to the fraud question. In fact, in the Zerilla case, Zerilla said you need to go back and look at the contract answer. Yes, they found a contract there, but the court said no. You look to the fraud submission. Even if the contract question in question one was solely related to the dealership, you could still have inconsistent findings because they're different claims with different elements. Here, all you need is a false promise, and the question is, in order to get benefit of the bargain damages, what the cases say, even the Haas case they relied on, is you need proof of an enforceable contract. And they have not challenged the false promise that this jury found. They have not challenged the enforceability of that promise. They've only challenged the enforceability of the promise based upon the statute of frauds, which the jury didn't award us real estate. It's not part of the fraud damages. With respect to causation, what the evidence is, and it's undisputed, that Mr. Durant was the source of this vicious lie. He started it. He testified unequivocally when he went to Cody. No one had told him or made any accusation that they believed that Mr. Anderson was involved in kickbacks. And what the test is, according to Texas case law, is it reasonably foreseeable that that statement may be repeated? In the testimony of Mr. Durant, he testified he knew that word travels fast in the car business. And they said that Mr. Cody was the investigator on this. First of all, both of them unequivocally testified under oath that there was no investigation into kickback. But he said Mr. Cody was the guy leading the investigation. But then he goes and tells Mr. Allen, who wasn't part of the investigation, and a guy by the name of Doyle Maynard, who was reported to Mr. Anderson. He was below Mr. Anderson in Granbury. And he tells Mr. Maynard, a guy that Mr. Anderson, and this is in the record, Mr. Anderson had written up 3 days earlier for being drunk on the job. He tells Mr. Maynard that Mr. Anderson took kickbacks. And we know Cody then tells people outside the organization, and there is no dispute that this allegation spread, just like Mr. Durant knew it would, because word travels fast in the car business. And Mr. Durant was the source. And it simply wasn't reasonably foreseeable that that statement would be repeated. Now, with respect to damages, it is fundamental that a defamation plaintiff can get both general and special damages. And when we're talking about general damages, this court knows it's particularly personal. There is no fixed standard, and it is solely within the province of the jury. What the cases say is only in the event that these awards are a result of passion or prejudice should they be disturbed. In the Durant, neither the Durant's defendants or the other defendants have made any argument to you that the damages awards were the result of passion and prejudice. Take reputation. What is your name worth? What is your name worth? That is highly personal. But what the jury heard was Mr. Durant testified his name was worth $44 million. What the jury also heard was this is the worst singular allegation that can be made about a car dealer. It would be no worse than to have a sitting judge be falsely accused of taking kickbacks. It would be career-ending.
It wouldn't be career-ending if no one believed it, would it?
Right, but we do know, and you hit on it, Mr. Hiley point-blank said, I could not take the risk. And what we also know is for 9 months after, he tried to get a job. He interviewed with 6 or 7 other dealerships. And most people aren't going to tell you, hey, I've heard about this. I'm not going to hire you what we know is he did not get hired for the 6 or 7 dealerships. He made $3,000 for 9 months. He was making upwards of $300,000. The only job he could get was buying wholesale cars for a friend of his. So we do know that he attempted to get jobs. He didn't get jobs. And we do know that many people within the organization who testified at trial, again, there was no evidence that Mr. Anderson now can't be trusted. When we know the evidence, all of the allegations they made in their brief about these are reasons to be suspicious, well, in real time, when they terminated Mr. Anderson, Plaintiff's Exhibit 14, when they terminated him, there is a place to check for violating company policy, stealing, insubordination. They didn't check any of that. This whole story about the suspicion was made up after the fact. When you get to emotional distress damages, the cases say that we're to put on evidence of the nature, duration, and severity of the mental distress damages. Here, in the record, he testified that he wakes up every day, depressed, that his life has been ruined, that he suffers from anxiety, paranoia. There are periods of time where he could not go out. He's worried about what people were saying about him. It's a small community. And he went to see a psychiatrist. He was treated for anti-anxiety. He had anti-anxiety medication. Depression alone is enough to be severe mental anguish. In fact, in the Rentec case, an award of $1.75 million was upheld where there was only a showing of depression, thoughts of suicide, and addiction. And out of this court, we have the Odell case. There was a $425,000 award for depression, nightmares, and shakes. And so the test is, was the verdict a result of passion and prejudice? And they haven't even argued that. When we get to lost income, they cite the Hines case. What the Hines case says is you cannot get defamation damages for termination. You can get lost income based upon the defamatory statement. And the jury was charged in this case to award lost income, not based upon the termination, but upon the defamation. And here, what we have is Mr. Anderson testifying to what he previously made, and he used a very conservative number. It was $200,000 when he was making upwards of $300,000, and up to trial, how much he actually made. That's easy to calculate. And then on a go-forward basis, they say you can't get lost income, but the Supreme Court in Waste Management and Hancock says you can get lost income in a defamation case. and we had our expert take Mr. Anderson's prior earnings, take the anticipated expectancy of how many more years he had left in the industry, and to present value that, so there was more than enough evidence to support that case. And if there are no further questions, I'll give you back some time.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
And let's see, okay. Mr. Barton.
Thank you. Regarding Anderson's argument about the Zorilla case and the fraud damages, there simply is no evidence to support the idea that the jury found an enforceable contract or promise in the fraud question that was separate from the actual contract question that was submitted in question number one. I'll refer the court to volume 10 of the reporter's record, page 147. Anderson's counsel is asking him, question, was there any doubt in your mind that the offer related to not only the dealerships, but the land upon which the dealerships sit? Answer, no doubt. Page 151, question, when Mr. Durant offered you a 10% ownership in the Granberry dealerships and the land, did you rely on that representation? Answer, you bet I did. There simply is no evidence of the promise that they want to say made its way into the fraud question. It would be like if I agreed to paint somebody's car and I testify that I agreed to paint the car blue, and the other person testified that I agreed to paint the car red. The jury has to determine, was it blue or was it red? Or the jury might determine, well, y'all didn't agree on anything at all. But the jury cannot determine that I agreed to paint it yellow. And that is what Anderson's argument is about the Zorilla case. And it's fatally flawed. There's no evidence to support it. With respect to causation, causation is different than the whole privilege issue. Obviously, we contend that the jury correctly held that Jerry's statements were privileged, and that the jury erred that conclusively Doyle Maynard's statements were privileged. But causation is just different, and they want to say their fundamental argument is that Jerry had the suspicion. He talked to his management people, and therefore he's liable for anything that gets said to anybody out on the street, any rumor. Their evidence of connecting Jerry to the rumors out on the street, it just does not pan out. And I'll read some examples to the court. Amanda Hedrick, this is in volume 27, page 85 and 86. She doesn't know where she heard the rumor. It didn't impair her opinion of Anderson at all. Mark Clark, he did not testify that he believed anything that Cote told him. Carol Walsh, this is in volume 27, page 119 and 120. She had no discussions with Jerry, didn't hear any rumors from Doyle, and at page 130, she has no opinion about Anderson's reputation. Chuck Terrell, volume 21, page 21, never spoke to anyone at the Durant organization about Anderson. Page 24, has no knowledge about Anderson's reputation. Their theory, they're asking the court to hold, if an employer talks, management personnel talk to themselves about suspicions about an employee's conduct, boom, they're automatically liable. That will have a chilling effect on employers' right to look into suspicious conduct. It's just not the law. On lost income, just very briefly, a statement that Jerry or Doyle made in a private conversation with Durant Management could not have had any impact on how much somebody else offered or was willing to pay Anderson in a subsequent job. It just could not. There's no causation there. And so, again, for the reasons that are in the brief, we would ask that the court reverse and render or reverse and remand. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there separate arguments on the appeal by Anderson? Are we through?
I think we're completed.
All right. Well, good. Well, your case is submitted. Thank you very much for excellent, thorough briefs and arguments. And you are excused.